California is a state filled with soaring trees, miles of wilderness, a long, rugged coastline, and the San Andreas Fault. Today, we explore all of this. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Prolific author and curious man, Jonah Raskin has written a book that examines American literature through the lens of our contemporary environmental crisis in A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature. We'll speak with him in just a moment. A little later in the broadcast, we'll hear my conversation with geologist Thomas E. Cochran, whose book, Shaping the Sonoma-Mendocino Coast, Exploring the Coastal Geography of Northern California, is a travel guide as much as a primer in plate tectonics. Something to consider when planning your road trip up the coast. It's all ahead. It's a novel idea. Wilderness is a concept that seems uniquely American and has defined much of the American character, even as industry and policy strive to destroy it. Wilderness, facing the unknown, conquering it, or being conquered by it, are themes woven into the landscape of American literature. And Jonah Raskin methodically reveals this to us in A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature, which not only deconstructs our literary heritage, but meditates on the inspiration of our natural world. Raskin is the author of many articles, essays, reviews, and books, including American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the Making of the Beat Generation, The Radical Jack London, Writings on War and Revolution, Field Days, A Year of Farming, Eating, and Drinking Wine in California, and Marijuana Land, Dispatches from an American War. Here now is my conversation with Jonah Raskin.
A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature. Why don't we just take it from the title? And this is a book that you say it's been in you for a long time.
Yes.
And that
right.
You've been compelled to approach this subject, and which has a lot to do with 19th century literature.
Yes.
And talk a little bit about that.
All right. Well, Suzanne, I just was thinking that you, I believe you know quite a bit or have deep feelings for trees, right?
I do.
So, I mean, trees are part of the story that I'm writing about. I mean, trees, there's individual trees. There's American writers were, or people who, Europeans who came here were just amazed at the different kind of species of trees, how many trees there were and the beauty of the trees. Trees make up woods and they make up forests and woods and forests in the New World or North America, as it was called, were also spectacular compared with Europe, because for hundreds of years people had been chopping down trees and using them for shipbuilding and fences and houses. And so that's in part why they said it was a new world, because it seemed to have all the things that had been depleted in the old world. And they had they believed that that whatever was here, all the resources would never run out. There was so much that human beings could never use it all up. And that was a story that played itself out again and again and again. And as people arrived on the East Coast and moved to the West Coast, and the story, what happened was that you were using up resources from woods on the East Coast into buffalo and oysters in San Francisco Bay. Now, it is also true that that nature or the wild is resilient, and it very often does come back. And humanity, our species, is trying to help bring it back.
There is that sense of hope. You end the book on a note of hope. Yet it seems that a lot of the work that you focus on really describes not only that abundance that is before people, but also the destruction of that abundance or the conquering of that abundance, especially when it comes to the native people who lived here too. So it seems that there is that constant struggle of conquering, ownership, domination.
Yes.
And in some ways, we've never really come to terms with that. I think we still don't come to terms with. We still have this feeling that this abundance is going to continue.
Yes. Right. I still hear people say that. They talk about the amazing fecundity. That's the word that I've heard people use in this whole Bay Area. And yes, you can go out and walk around and see the diversity of life. But I just coming here on the radio, I heard a report that the salmon returning to the streams in Marin is the lowest it has ever been. It has been for the last decade and a half. So, and a lot of people say, like, the salmon are the equivalent of the canaries in the gold mine. So there's something very sad and unfortunate that's going on here, the loss of our salmon population, and especially the cohos. You know, it's a story that's also told in a new movie that's called The Russian River, All Rivers, and of what's happened to the fish population. It used to be that the fish were an integral part of Indian life around here, and as for food and part of ritual. And there may have been some exaggeration, but they used to say, Indian tales used to say, there'd be so many salmon in the rivers you could walk across a stream that there were so many, right?
And the same, I think, has been said about birds darkening the sky as they flew overhead. And I know even here in Sonoma County right now, I have friends who say they don't hear the same birds that they heard even 5 years ago.
And yes.
Well, what do you think is that we don't know how to live in nature?
Why is that?
Do you think human beings do not know how to live in nature?
Well, some of them do. Some people know how to be in nature with sort of coexist with nature and respect it. And I think that people are learning. I know that also that there was a time not that long ago when lots of young kids were afraid to go into nature. They were told that there were snakes. Emily Dickinson in the mid-19th century was told, don't go into the woods because there's snakes there and it's dangerous. I mean, that is also a story that Americans have been telling for a very long time about the dangers of the woods and the dangers of nature. There are things that are poisonous and they'll bite you and they'll kill you. And I know that there have been some successful attempts, and there are places all around the country, and here especially, where kids are part of school. They get taken into the woods, and they identify flowers and learn the names of rivers, and they learn about watersheds. So there are – it's not too late. From speaking to people, I've only recently been talking about this book and the subject matter, but people do want – to have a sense of hope. They want to know, well, what can I do and what are people doing around here that can inspire me? And I do tell some dark stories or I write about some dark books. Moby Dick is a kind of dark, very dark book about this maniacal sea captain who wants to kill this whale. And it's a kind of parable about... I see it as a parable about Americans sort of wanting to destroy nature. They want revenge. They feel like nature has done them wrong, and they want to get back at it. So to get back to the sort of the beginning of our conversation, I was talking about trees and woods and forests, and I did also wanted to sort of leap to wilderness. I mean, today, probably if you mention the word wilderness to people, they think of, like, I would say probably a park or sort of a big tract of land that's – it could be thickly wooded or it – I mean, we also have we have desert wilderness. I mean, there's all – every kind of environment has its own different kind of wilderness. So the word and the concept of wilderness is very fascinating to me that when the Puritans, I would say, the Puritans of the 17th century, hundreds of years ago, are the people most responsible for kind of planting the image and the idea and the story of the wilderness in North America. I mean, and then it kind of it's a story that, like, really took off here and took hold. I mean, there were English people who wrote about the wild. I mean, there are tales of knights who go on quests and they go into the wilderness. And Shakespeare used the word. So it was around before people really were in the English language, before American literature took off. But it's something that really I think that the wilderness and USA, America, are almost synonymous. So the Puritans, by wilderness, meant a place where God wasn't there. It was it was pagan. It was where heathens lived, and they felt that they thought of it as this horrible place where the devil lived. And in order to get to the promised land, they had to go through this terrible, horrible place that they called the wilderness, and they found the book in the Bible where in the Old Testament, the Jews go out into the wilderness to get to their promised land, and Jesus also goes into the wilderness. It's a place also where there's special spiritual moments take place. You're tested in the wilderness, or in the New and the Old Testament, the Moses and Jesus their feet are brought to the fire there, and it's something that they have to overcome spiritually if they're going to get to where they're going to be. And that's the way that the Puritans applied it. They didn't say, oh, look at this place with all these wonderful trees and forest, and let's call it a wilderness. No, they were reading the Bible, and the Bible was so real to them that they took the biblical wilderness and they planted it on this place. So, and that lasted for a long, long time. Yes.
In the book, you talk a lot about the writing of James Fenimore Cooper.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I read Cooper in maybe junior high or high school. And as you ticked off some of the titles, I thought, gee, I think I might have read that book. But at the time, perhaps I didn't have an understanding. I mean, I know I didn't get into it at the time. I don't know if there are still in the curriculum today, if the Deerslayer, for instance, is part of what young people read these days. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, James Fenimore Cooper is still read. He's not read as much as it used to be. It used to be like you went to college, you had to read James Fenimore Cooper. It was part of being an American, was to read The Last of the Mohicans and the Pioneers and the Deerslayer and the Prairie. And in more recent times, I would say maybe the last 30 or so years, Cooper has been gently edged out of the curriculum, and writers, women writers and writers of color have been put in his place, which I think is a good thing, because for a long time, people thought, well, it's only white men who are writing about the wild in the wilderness. But in Well, beginning in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, there were lots of women writers, very fine women writers like Catherine Maria Sedgwick and Lydia Maria Child, who they read James Fenimore Cooper, and they said let's feminize the Cooper's landscape. They decided consciously to tell stories about women who go into the wild and into the wilderness. And they are basically different stories than the stories that Cooper told. They're much less about conquering and having control, and they're much more about living in harmony with the continent, with the world of nature. And they also have a different view about sex and romance and the two races or ethnicities getting together. Cooper was like really afraid of mixing of what he would call blood of redskins and pale faces as he saw them getting together, whereas the white writers, the white women writers, Sedgwick and Child, wrote about romances and between Indian men and white women in places where Indian men, the women go into the wilderness and they live happily ever after there. I mean, that is also part of the American story. From the earliest times, there were people who saw the value of Indian society. Now, the person to me who's the father of wilderness writing is Roger Williams, who's best known as for creating the state of Rhode Island, and a very unusual, unique person. He lived part of his life in England and part in the United States. He was friendly with John Milton, and he was a great linguist. And he wrote the first wilderness poems, consciously writing poems about the place that he called the wilderness. He recognized that it had a poetic appeal and poetic force. So he realized that the Indians had government, they had stories, they had families, they had customs and rituals, they had beliefs. They farmed. Indians...
were not savages.
Exactly. They had a civilization, all of their own. And
that kind of perspective isn't the one that took off?
Right. It mostly became a kind of dichotomy. We're the people who are civilized, and you're the savages, and we have to convert you to civilization. Unfortunate, because I think there are a lot of things that settlers and colonists could have learned from the Indians about how to
survive.
Exactly. how to survive and how to live without having to conquer it. I think everybody, every school kid hears the stories about Thanksgiving and where the pilgrims wouldn't have survived if the Indians hadn't come and brought them things to eat, because they didn't know how to where they were going to, how to farm or how to plant corn and how to fish and all those things that the Indians had knew how to do, and they learned from the Indians because they had to in order to survive. Yes.
So Jonah, your desire to see this book through, is it that you yourself, over the course of your life, have noticed these elements of books you've read and in American literature and felt that there was a story to be told that maybe we weren't hearing?
I think that it's that Americans have lost sight of a lot of their literature. We've lost sight of a lot of our literature, or if we know about it, we haven't really. The theme of the wilderness does really run through all of American literature, and for the most part, I don't think Americans have really realized that. All the variations on the theme, it's been treated in so many different ways, but it is a thread that runs all the way through. I think that The spark for the book was a movie that I saw, I believe, in about 2007. It was called Into the Wild. It was by Sean Penn, and was based on a book by John Krakauer called Into the Wild. It's about a young man named Christopher McCandless who reads Jack London, and after reading Jack London, decides that he wants to go into the wilderness. He believes that he's going to conquer the wilderness. And if people have read the book or seen the movie, they know that he doesn't survive. He dies. He dies in the school bus that he's living in. He doesn't really know what to bring with him, what he needs to have, and what it takes to survive. He's in his head, and he's living in this kind of fantasy world. So I think that is it showed me the continuity from Jack London, who wrote The Call of the Wild in the early part of the 20th century, to Into the Wild at the end of the 20th century. That with the stories that we told, as in The Call of the Wild, The Call of the Wild is about a dog named Buck who's kidnapped from California and he's taken to the Yukon, and he learns to how to adapt. I mean, this was Jack London believed that. It's a kind of parable about the need to adapt to whatever circumstances we're in as human beings, and he did believe that. Yes, that human beings were a species who could adapt to anything. They had what he called plasticity. But then increasingly, the stories that got told at the end of the 20th century were about men who went on these adventures and didn't come out of the woods or didn't come out of the wilderness, who had sort of lost the ability. And I believe that we're at the start of a kind of new cycle that I would see exemplified in both the book and the movie called Wild by Cheryl Strayed. And that's a book about that's Cheryl Strayed's story about her own adventures on the Pacific Crest Trail. I mean, walking over 1,000 miles in some ways it's a familiar story because Americans have seen going into nature, I think at least from the time of Emerson and Thoreau, as a kind of therapy. Emerson and Thoreau, they would say, well, I get down and depressed if I'm in town and I need solitude and I want to get away from machines and technology. And if I go into the woods and take a walk or go into the wilderness, I feel like I'm become a new person. And Cheryl Strayed writes about the death of her mother and use of heroin and divorce and realizing that she needs to get away and it's to go by herself on this, epic journey.
That she was unprepared for.
Really, yes. But I think that we're living in a time where there are young women who are brave and courageous enough to take on this struggle and to learn how to adapt to being away from home and computers and cell phones and that people really want to do that they feel it's something very necessary for their own mental and physical health.
And I wonder, though, if that is if an individual here or a handful of people there who are seeing the value and experiencing it for themselves without dying in a school bus necessarily have the potency to actually change how we as a culture approach nature and appropriate nature. Because I fear that I'm not very hopeful when I see wonderful places that are trashed, really, by our trash and yes. and disregard and lack of understanding. Earlier you mentioned watersheds, that sometimes I believe we don't even understand how our systems work, and we're just yes. an element of that system. And so I don't always feel as hopeful that we can create that kind of momentum for change. Yet I have a sense that in your book, that your book is a paving stone in that direction, or maybe I don't know if you see it that way, but I thought it was interesting that in your book, you're quoting Cooper saying that books are in a great measure the instruments of controlling the opinions of a nation like ours.
Yes.
They're an engine alike powerful to save or to destroy. And
yes.
So that really did pop out at me as something that you felt compelled to write this book. And I wonder if it is your push or attempt to save something, to inspire people to be more cognizant.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that people, we can look to our own literature for inspiration. We can go back to Thoreau and reread Walden or read the sort of essays that Thoreau wrote about walking and around Concord, Massachusetts, or going to Maine, the woods of Maine, and seeing what was going on there, or Emerson's essays about nature, or reading Willa Cather's like O Pioneers, which is again, it's like a story. The main character is a woman, and she learns how to live in this very harsh environment in Nebraska, the prairies of Nebraska, where, I mean, it's cold and it's windy and it's hot and it does. She does. Willa Cather does suggest that it's the old Europeans who bring with them to this what I would call a kind of godforsaken land. Sort of a European appreciation of the soil and of nature. I think it is something, well, D.H. Lawrence also says it when he writes about American literature, that Europeans have this kind of connection to the soil and to the earth that maybe because they lived there for, they and their ancestors had lived there for hundreds and thousands of years, that they really felt connected to the place, whereas Americans for so long came here and felt like alien and not rooted. And the stories that they often told were about people who were rootless and alienated from the place. And so I have heard I've heard people say, and I've been saying it myself, that we knew part of the what we need to do, I believe, is to tell different stories, to change the narrative, and to begin to tell stories about the ways that we're connected to this place, connected to the land, to the wilderness. And there are real connections. There, we're not just, you know, making up fairy tales.
I just want to say that you do quote Gary Snyder, "The wild is a territory, not a part of the agency of humanity. It could be a strip of earth in your own backyard, or it could be Yosemite. Wherever it is, it takes care of itself."
Yeah. Yes. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature by Jonah Raskin. Jonah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Right. My conversation with Jonah Raskin on his book, A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature. Let's take a short break, and get ready for some rockin' and rollin' up the Sonoma and Mendocino Coast with geologist Thomas E. Cochran, whose book is Shaping the Sonoma-Mendocino Coast, exploring the coastal geography of Northern California. I'm Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Stay with us.
The sun is shining bright across the sky, and yet I can't help but wonder why. Your beauty, will it always remain? Will it take away and wash away my pain? The sea is like a crystal shine.
That was Karen Dreyer and her song, Mendocino County Line, from her album, Start to Believe. We are on this planet for just a speck of time. Sometimes we have the rare experience to witness the movement of the geologic features around us. But often, we only see the results. Thomas Cochran presents us with a geologic exposé, along with the route of a pretty good road trip up the coast, in his Shaping the Sonoma-Mendocino Coast, Exploring the Coastal Geography of Northern California, available at Copperfields, Amazon, and some of the kiosks in local establishments around the county. I had the real pleasure of meeting up with him just before he gave a reading in Santa Rosa, California, at Gaia's Garden, which has become a literary hub for readings and hosts the regular Dining with Authors series. You'll hear a lot of the festivities in the background, and I hope you'll enjoy our conversation. Thomas E. Cochran, Shaping the Sonoma and Mendocino Coast. We're here in a lovely cafe to talk about your book right before you're going to do a reading tonight.
Correct. So, yes.
You're a geologist and you live up at or have had a lot of experience up in the Sea Ranch area. Though the book isn't Sea Ranch centric, it does use that as a locus for your conversation in the book. Did living up there, or did so many people talk to you about geology or want to talk to you that you felt you just had to write a book?
Yes, for years. I mean, I discovered California in 1976 and moved here full-time in 88. And, of course, I found the Sea Ranch as my first place in California. So as quick as I got out here, being a geologist, I started to look at the geology. And having been raised in the East and gone to school in the Midwest and worked in the oil business in the south central part of the U.S., California was different, very different. And the book covers more than just seaweed. And it started out to update a small book that Ted Koningsmark had done a few years ago, but it soon expanded to cover all of Sonoma County and at least half of Mendocino County along the coast. So,
and anybody who's driven or hiked along the coast knows not just in a superficial way about the San Andreas Fault, or maybe only in a superficial way about the San Andreas Fault, but many of the coves and beaches and cliffs that we might encounter on our hikes, definitely, they almost look like they're still moving.
I think everything is moving. I mean, the continents are drifting slowly west, and this little section of, 538 miles is moving north along the St. Andreas Fault. So, everything is moving, and finding the exact trace of the fault is not always easy. And this book, I do a road log, is the second half of this book that goes from Bodega Bay to Elk with 150 stops that you might stop at. And, of course, where you can see the San Andreas Fault, where it goes offshore and comes onshore. And even there, it's hard to see.
I found in the book that you definitely are using the language of a geologist, but it seems like you also tried to make it very understandable to those of us who don't have that as a background. How did you go about doing that?
I tried not to use terms that most of us are not familiar with unless you're a geologist. You can't talk about geology without using some terms, but I tried to keep them. I mean, everybody knows what a fault is and probably what an anticline is and maybe a syncline. But beyond that, I don't go into complex, overturned faults with all kinds of wild throws, and of course geologists have terminology for each one of these. I didn't go do any of that. I tried to show what's here and where you can look at it.
Tell us what the syncline and anticline is, just for those of us who don't know.
Well, anticline is where the sediment, where the layers of rock are warped up into a hill shape, and a syncline, they're warped downward into a hollow or a...
You also used a term, sag ponds, that I found interesting. So tell us also what a sag pond is and where we might find one.
There are a lot of sag ponds along the coast. To see the fault, unless you can actually see two sections of rock that are moved by each other, and you can say, ooh, this rock is here, and there's a crack, and it's over here, then you know you have a fault. But most of the faults are covered up by the weathering of the sediments, and the soil has covered them so that you can't see where they are. But the sag ponds are little areas that slumped during the moving of the fault, and they formed a little pond. They had a fault on one side, and they just slid down, or they may be on the side of a hill where they slid down, and we find them all along the coast, and whenever you find one, it's related to a fault. And probably to the St. Andreas Fault.
Might we drive right by one and not know what we're looking at, or are they filled with water?
Yeah, most of them are filled with water. I've identified three ages of sag ponds. We have the 1906 big San Francisco earthquake, and those sag ponds are very fresh, and they have water in them, and they're completely surrounded by some kind of a mound or hill. The older ones, the streams have cut into them to drain the pond, and therefore they're notched on one side. And then as they get more eroded and older and older and older, then they just become a little sag that connects to a stream.
So we are not only living in one of the most beautiful places on the planet, we are living in one of the most dynamic ones geologically.
Correct. Everything is moving. Now, a lot of it's moving very slowly, so we don't see it. I mean, you don't see how fast the Earth is turning. I mean, the Earth is 25,000 miles around, and it turns in one day. So it's moving 1,000 miles an hour. We don't see how fast the Earth is making its travels in a year, but it's moving at 66,000 miles an hour. So we don't see those things, but scientists are able to measure them, and if we look hard, we can see them.
I found it interesting when you talked about the measures of movements and maybe inches. So inches in a year is really quite a bit of movement, isn't it?
Right, yes. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and, you know, to study this area, you can't hardly eliminate the rest of the world. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge is spreading an inch or two apart a year, so the Atlantic Ocean is getting wider. And if the Atlantic Ocean is getting wider, then the Pacific Ocean has got to be getting smaller. Now, in the Fukushima earthquake, we jumped, or they jumped, 8 feet towards us. 8 feet in one movement. And this is how it works. The strain works up, and St. Andreas Fault, since the 1906 quake, has moved an inch or an inch and a half. But it hasn't moved at the surface. It's moved way down 5 or 6 miles in the ground. So the question is, when is it going to break loose to the surface? And then where?
In the book, you use the term deep time. Is that what you're talking about?
Right, deep time. None of us can really imagine deep time. And particularly go to a grade school class and try to tell an 8 or 10-year-old about deep time. And they can't even imagine the length of their parents' lifetime, or maybe even 10 years. So to try to explain them millions and billions of years is virtually impossible. And it is for us, too. We can't really conceive of it. But we can make mathematical measurements that will illustrate it to you. If I tell you that the St. Andreas Fault has moved 350 miles along its trace, and it's moved it in 30 million years, well, you can take 30 million years, and you can take, you know, the time, and then you mathematically can do that. And when you do that, you'll come back to this inch or inch and a half per year number. And I have a lot of fun with this. I've taken my maps, and I cut them along the St. Andreas Fault, and then I move the plates to go back to see, well, where was Point Arena 4 million years ago?
Where was it?
It was south of the Sea Ranch, just south of the Sea Ranch. And the interesting thing at this, in that area of the St. Andreas Fault, we have a river basin called the Walla River Watershed, and it is 300 square miles. And 4 million years ago, it was a bay, just like San Pablo Bay. So it was below sea level, and in 4 million years, and it opened to the sea. I mean, there was sea right at the fault, so that the sea came in just like it comes in at the Golden Gate, although there wasn't even a string of hills there. It was just flat, open ocean to the Walla River watershed. And it filled with 500 or 800 feet of sediments. And since that time, it has been raised 3,000 feet. And half of it's been eroded.
There was something else I found interesting in your conversation. You talked about a Carboniferous period. Am I saying that right? Carboniferous.
Carboniferous, okay, yeah.
And when you're describing this deep time and you talk about coal, it made me think that maybe I don't understand anything about coal. I guess I always thought that coal was the process of compression, But maybe that's just something I learned in second grade and have carried with me for all these years. So tell us about coal and carboniferous periods.
Okay, well, coal is a compressed plant. So yes, you were correct there. There were these vast swamps, just like, well, like the Amazon. And the area in Pennsylvania was at the equator at that time. So it was a tropical swamp that lasted for thousands and millions of years through the entire Pennsylvanian period and part of the Mississippian, which collectively are called the Carboniferous. At the same time, in Oklahoma, there was oil and gas being deposited in the same age rocks. And the oil and gas was again from decaying things, but probably from microscopic sea life, from protozoa and plankton and all those kind of things were compressed to form the oil and the gas. Now, if you draw a line between Oklahoma and Pennsylvania, you'll see that there's a big angle. I mean, Oklahoma's a lot further south. And they were both down at the equator during the Carboniferous time. So that tells us a lot about the drifting of the continents, the actual movement of the plate. So all of North America is moving north, and yet it's swinging to the west. Fun times for geologists.
Well, we're talking about the geology, but as we're talking about it, I am thinking about some of the illustrations in your book and the pictures in your book, and we are talking about a book you've produced for us. So how did you decide and get, you have some maps and stuff, how did you handle the production of the book with regard to the maps and illustrations? And I'm thinking of, too, you have the drifting continents and that sort of thing. So what about the production?
The production, I wrestled with that a long time. I wanted to do, a table-sized book so I could put large maps in it and large photographs. And then we got into the cost of that. And then I thought, the information about that's here is what I want to get across to people. And the photos are in there just to spark you to go out and take your own photo, because you're probably a better photographer than I am. And I have several cameras, and I ended up using only my iPhone for the photos. So all the photos in the book are from my iPhone. And, you know, I have better cameras that could put out better things and so on, but I just went back there. The photos are to spark you to go and look at that spot. And if you're there at the right time, you'll get a lot better shot than the one I have in the book. And what I would ask for the reader is send me a copy of your favorite picture along the coast.
And sometimes those pictures can help us understand what we're looking at a little bit more. You had a picture in the book of Bowling Ball Beach, and talk a little bit about Bowling Ball Beach. Describe Bowling Ball Beach to those of us who haven't been there.
Well, Bowling Ball Beach has probably been photographed and visited by many people on the coast. You can only see the bowling balls at low tide. So when people are up here picking abalone at very low tides, that's the time to go to Bowling Ball Beach, because you'll see it. A lot of times when you go, if it's just a low tide, you might get your feet wet. You might get to them or see them sticking up through the water, but you need the really low tides to see them. And then I'll let you read the book. I can tell you how the shelf was formed out there as the advancing sea is coming in and it's eroding the current bluff, and it's slowly retreating 1 to 3 inches a year. And we have this great platform out there of very steeply dipping rocks and rocks that stick up that are the harder rocks, and then a foot away is a shale, and they look like bowl-like alleys. They just look like alleys. And then suddenly there's this one area with maybe 100 round balls that are about 4 feet in diameter. And somehow they got there. And I have no clue where they came from. They did not come out of the bluff, I mean, we see some in the Bluff, but the biggest one I've seen in the, well, there's some that I call the hamburger buns. There's a photograph in the book. I don't know how those are formed, but those are coming out of the, actually coming out of the rocks. And then there are some small balls that are maybe a foot or foot and a half in diameter, and they're filled with worm burrows. So marine worms burrowed them, and maybe they're even nests, because you don't see the worm burrows in the rocks much between these round things that are in the Bluff. So there's a lot to learn there.
Do you mean they were nests, like in an ancient time or a different incarnation, and this is the artifact of what was something else?
Yes, they're fossils, in effect, although they're just the boring, the actual. Well, worms are soft-bodied creatures. They don't last. So, and these are marine worms, and they're not like an earthworm. They're probably considerably bigger.
So the bowling ball beach, the bowling balls at Bowling Ball Beach, and you do have a picture of this in the book, remain a mystery.
I think they're a mystery. If you ask any geologists how they're formed, they'll say, oh, they're concretions around a fossil or around a hard bit of rock or something, and that's how they formed, and they just slowly formed. But the concretions that I've looked at or have split with my rock hammer, they flake off in layers because these things kind of collected as a small layer around, a fossil, and then they collected another layer and another layer and another. These sandstone balls are round, and we don't have any one that's cut right in the middle, but we have one that's split about a third of the way off, and I don't see anything in the middle.
Interesting. Somewhere else in the book, you talk about roundness, or that you said, I believe, you've never really seen a round spherical stone.
Right.
And I had a theory about that.
Oh, good.
Because, so I want to run my theory by you of a sphere seems to be, it would be formed from a spinning process where a more egg-shaped rock would be from a, more of a tumbling. And so what do you think my theory?
Yeah, they're all formed tumbling on the beach. And if you go, I mean, this is a very good year because normally we have sand on the beach, and even in the winter times we have some sand, although the sand moves out each year and then comes back in. This year it's all moved out, and all you have are rolling rocks on many of these beaches. And when you hear them roll and they're banging, and the most exciting time for me is to go down there at night when it's dark and you hear those banging rocks rolling in and out of the beach. And as they roll, of course they bang together, and then they erode and they get smaller and smaller and smaller. But none of them get to be a sphere like a ball. And I always tell little kids when I take them on a field trip, I'll give you $100 if you can find me a perfectly spherical rock. And I have yet to pay the $100.
And if they find it, it's probably some sort of maritime debris, you know. We're talking with Thomas E. Cochran, and the book is Shaping the Sonoma and Mendocino Coast. And you had some other terms that, you know, earlier you talked about geologists having, you know, your own language in a way, but some of it I thought was lovely. Green schist clinkers. Can you tell us a little bit about what a green, and you do also talk about blue schist in the book too, or mention it, but so what is a green schist clinker?
Green schist is a low degree, is a geologic term for a low degree of metamorphism. And there are, you get different kinds of minerals in it. You get chlorite, garnets come out of a more heavily metamorphosed rock. The clinkers we see along the coast, and they end on the Skaggs Spring, on the Myers Grade Road, you come to the end of these clinkers, and the clinkers are these knobs that stick up in the meadow. And if they're close enough to the ocean and they've been incorporated in one of the terraces, they're the basis of a fossil sea stack. But a lot of them are just there on the hillside, and you wonder, what are they doing there? Because they're in a sedimentary rock. The sedimentary rock is called the Franciscan Formation. And geologists use formation names. If I say Franciscan Formation to a geologist, he knows exactly what formation I'm talking about, and he knows its age and its approximate lithology and so on. So we name things like we name people. When you say their name, you have this vision of who they are, and we have this vision of who the rock formation is. Well, the Franciscan Formation forms the coastal ranges, much of it, and the coastal ranges the sediments were formed during the Jurassic period when the dinosaurs were rolling around, except the dinosaurs were inland and the Franciscan Formation was off the edge of the continent at the time. So all of California is younger than the dinosaurs, in effect. So as the continent plate moved, the Franciscan Formation got faulted and folded and pushed up into all these little coastal ranges that parallel the coast. And the clinkers are a little spot in there that where the friction between these two folding plates got so intense that it semi-melted the sandstone and allowed other minerals to form. So that's what the clinkers are.
So when we sometimes we stop while we're hiking and we have a picnic at some rock outcroppings, are those clinkers?
Depends where you are. Some of them are, yes.
Just fishing, I guess. You also, in the book, you're mainly talking about geology, but you can't help but talk about, as you mentioned, the dinosaurs and life forms and the evolution of life forms. And I think on the coastal area with of course, we have very few old growth redwood stands, but there seems to be a whole biological synchronicity or between the vegetation, the rock and soil, the water, and the fish, for instance, that is kind of all interdependent on one another.
Everything depends on everything else, and it all. I mean, I picked the geology for this book with very little discussion of the wildlife, and mainly because there are books. I mean, there's a lot of books on sea life. There's a lot of books on trees. There's books on wildflowers, and this is a great wildflower time. And the thing that always amazes me about the wildflowers is, why do these wildflowers, why are they the very best on the points? These points are the most windswept points in the world, and yet they have better flowers than next to the coves. And I mean, maybe the flower experts can tell me why that is, but I don't have an answer for that. But that's where you find them.
Interesting. Well, we certainly live in a very dynamic part of the world, part of the coast, and you have given us a wonderful path to follow, to literally follow, and understand it more deeply.
Good. Thank you.
Well, thanks for sitting down and talking with me today about your book, Shaping the Sonoma-Mendocino Coast, Exploring the Coastal Geology of Northern California. Thomas E. Cochran, thank you.
Thank you.
My conversation with Thomas E. Cochran in the ever-bustling Gaia's Garden on Mendocino Avenue in Santa Rosa. They feature a regular Dining with Authors series. Tom's book is Shaping the Sonoma-Mendocino Coast, Exploring the Coastal Geography of Northern California. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Jonah Raskin with his book, A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature. I'm Suzanne Lang, and I hope you'll tune in again. Subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org and listen anytime. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.